an antenna. That's the good news. But because I've rotated the polarization, I'm 3 dB down from either. I've made that sacrifice. So all antennas, if you're not putting co-polarized energy into it, you're going to get crazy results, unless you're looking specifically for the so-called Condon lobes, the cross-polarization performance of that particular antenna. So every antenna you got to worry about. In the case of isotropic, it gets even more complicated. If I've got an antenna that's mounted in the middle of a sphere, and now I'm going to use words that are equator, longitude, latitude, north pole, south pole, to describe in the spherical coordinate world what's going on. Let me drop. So I got my antenna mounted in the middle of a sphere, and it's an isotropic antenna. And I make my first measurement right at the international date line at the equator. And I'm putting horizontal polarization in the antenna. And I make a measurement, and yes, I confirm it's isotropic, 0 dBi. And I make a measurement at the international date line, 180 degrees away. I get the same reading. I make a measurement at 90 degrees, which I guess is just south of Texas, and so on. But now as I start moving toward the North Pole, if I started off at the international date line, if I started off at the prime meridian, Greenwich meridian, and the equator, and I start moving my point of observation up to the North Pole, I get one kind of polarization measurement. If I take the same horizontal antenna, slide it along the equator over to the 90-degree point near Texas, just south of Texas, and now I move up toward the North Pole, that second measurement at the North Pole is that right angle polarization-wise to the first measurement. So a truly isotropic antenna and how you describe its polarimetry characteristics, you better make sure that you and the guy you're talking to are using the same words and so on. This thing really gets complicated when it comes to the coordinate system that's used by the antenna measuring science versus a real pilot. Let me drop. The antenna measuring guy takes a great circle cut measuring the cardinal planes of antenna performance, and he sweeps the antenna in azimuth and elevation in his manner. But the Air Force technique, done at the Rome Air Development Center, where I've worked with them for a few years, everything they do is pilot-oriented. 0 degrees of elevation to an antenna maven is zenith, straight up. They call that 0 degrees of elevation. A pilot says 0 degrees of elevation is his eyesight straight forward toward the nose of the airplane. That's his 0 degree point in elevation. And so you can see that rapidly as you start writing reports, you write an antenna report in an Air Force report to the Air Force about the antenna performance, you got a great big discontinuity here of vocabulary. So many of the Air Force manuals will tell you, you will report to us in pilot-referenced coordinate system. That pilot says 0 degrees of elevation is straight ahead, 90 degrees of elevation to him is straight overhead, whereas the antenna person says 90 degrees is straight ahead and 0 degrees is straight up. They got it backwards, if you know what I mean. So in the case of an isotropic antenna, it gets complicated. Can an isotropic antenna be circular polarized clockwise in all directions at once? Absolutely not. That's the so-called mathematics of the Poincaré sphere. If you take a look at the circular polarization chapter, let me drop. You take a look at one of the early chapters, I think it's chapter 2 or 3 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, and you read about the Poincaré sphere. They come up with a mathematical way of describing the polarimetry characteristics of an antenna. All antennas on the Poincaré sphere, where you're analyzing them on the equator, are linear polarized. But you slant that linear polarization. In other words, you start rotating around the boom of the Yagi, so to speak, in order not the mast, rotating around the boom, which is doing mathematically the equivalent of moving along the equator of that Poincaré sphere. The North Pole, I think, is counterclockwise, pure polarization. The South Pole is pure clockwise. And every other latitude and longitude point on the Poincaré sphere defines a certain level of elliptical polarization. And now when it comes to circular polarized antennas and orthogonality, in other words, if I had a pure clockwise circular polarized antenna, south pole, and a pure counterclockwise circular polarized antenna, north pole, and they look at each other, they see nothing. They are orthogonal. Okay? That's one combination of orthogonality. Every single point on that Poincaré sphere has an antipodal point on the opposite side, which will be orthogonal. So there's a certain kind of elliptical clockwise polarized antenna that has a counterpart of certain kind of elliptical counterclockwise polarization that when they look at each other, they see nothing. It's called orthogonal. So you start getting into polarization, and particular circular polarization, my goodness, Joe, you can have a grand old time with the mathematics and try to figure out what's going on. I know I didn't answer your question, but hopefully I've given you a little more...
Repeater, time out.
I know I didn't answer your question, but hopefully I've given you a little more information that'll help. WJ2B, K2LIW, go ahead, Joe.
Very good, Dick. I think I understood a little bit of what you said there, but I must add, in my 4 years of studying electrical engineering at Polytechnic, back then called Institute of New York, that was probably one of the most challenging subjects, was three-dimensional calculus and antenna theory. So that's a challenging challenging field, and I'm very impressed at your knowledge of it and you being able to try to explain it. But my take of this is that I would assume that it's almost impossible to actually build, you know, physically build an isotropic antenna. Is that correct, Dick, WJ2B?
Give that man a cigar. You found out the dirty secret, Joe. The whole antenna science, 90-some-odd% of the time, is reference to an isotropic antenna. And in the real world, the isotropic antenna does not exist. Boy, do they have a house of cards here. All the mathematics of this system is built on something that doesn't exist in reality, but mathematically, it's nice and simple. A light bulb in the middle of a spherical room is a isotropic antenna, but there's a catch. That light bulb is not putting out a definable polarization. It's thoroughly random in polarization, the light waves coming out of that light bulb. And that's why it can be isotropic, but it doesn't relate very directly to real antennas. The real antenna you and I build, it's got horizontal or vertical linear polarization, or clockwise or counterclockwise, quasi-circular or elliptical polarization. And the way they couple to each other, those two antennas and their polarization characteristics, mathematically it can be handled. The number of antenna engineers that have a good, warm feeling of how to deal with circular polarization is not a majority. The schools, again, don't do a very good job on this one. And it's not a simple area. You talk to a guy like Kent, WA5VJB, who's done a lot of antenna measurements by way of the antenna contest that they hold at each one of the get-togethers of the VHF societies. Why can't I think of the name of it now? It's not Midwest. All of a sudden, I can't think of the name of the main VHF society. Okay. And they gave me a nice big award. Boy, am I a good guy. Anyhow.
Repeater, time out.
What I'm getting at is Kent has run the antenna measurement contest at each of the VHF society meetings that get together. And he has seen a hell of a lot of so-called circular polarized antennas. And he's written a couple of very funny articles for the microwave reflector, where guys will appear with a helical antenna, which somebody had told them is going to be nearly circular polarized, and they put it on the antenna range and start measuring its gain, and a high percentage of the time they're disappointed, and they start measuring how circular polarized it is, and a high percentage of the time they're disappointed. So there's only an infinite number of ways you can make a bad circular polarized antenna, Joe. and there's only a nearly infinite number of ways you can do a bad job of testing a circular polarized antenna. And the requirements for a good outdoor antenna range that can properly handle a circular polarized antenna, it puts a hell of a lot of more restrictions on the antenna range itself. The reflective ground plane antenna range testing procedure doesn't work anywhere near as well on a circular polarized antenna. If you want good measurements there traceable to the Bureau, you better be working into a well-tuned anechoic chamber, because any reflection makes life complicated. A clockwise circular polarized wave bouncing once off the ground becomes primarily a counterclockwise wave. So each bounce reverses the sense of polarization. Doesn't that give you a little clue as to what's going on? That left-hand circular polarized feed horn you put in front of your parabolic dish antenna, left-hand feed horn, is going to give you a right-hand wave after it reflects off the dish. You better get that right when you're doing moon bounce, otherwise the guy you're talking to might not hear you. So hang in there, Joe. Don't let it intimidate you. If you stick with it long enough, it'll start making sense.
Repeater, time out.
If you stick with it long enough, it'll start making sense. But the biggest group of guys that have a moderately good understanding of circular polarization are ham radio operators. And you go into any of the real good antenna engineering laboratories, you'll be amazed how many times you will find on their bookshelf the AROL antenna handbook and the AROL radio amateurs handbook. Sometimes turned around backwards, you can't see the backbone of it. They're not willing to admit that one of their main references is a ham radio reference, even though they think they're a professional engineer in that subject. Okay, wonder if you've got another one we should go to, or do you think we should go to the space report? Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I think we should go over to Paul and get some of that great information he always has for us. Been a pleasure, and thanks for those answers, Dick. And we'll do it again. KC2WGB, over to you, Dick.
Quick comment, Dick, WJ2B. Go right ahead, Joe.
Just watched Nick Walenda walk across the Grand Canyon on a two-inch diameter stranded steel cable about 1,200 feet long. Wouldn't that make a great HF antenna? Load that thing up, WJ2B.
Comment on Chief Constellation.
It sure would. Oh, boy. And I hope there's a whole lot of braces to make sure that wire doesn't sway, because when you got a very long distance to travel and you're doing wire walking, the horizontal sway of the wire can really make life complicated. Is there one single brief subject that you want to mention here, Wes? N2XJN, K2RIW?
You know, we were talking about Silk Constellation, because I was trying to relate from the micro world to the macro world. And you said energy that is transmitted has to go somewhere. Well, in the X-ray refractometry and also in the antennas world, we're dealing with the point of orientation. And I would like you to give some more information, not really contradicting, but if you try to take my point and support it. They have a given point in space, and now from that point of space, you do the observation. And would that statement be valid about the field constellation of the antennas for that particular point? And to exit.
Quick comment, Dick?
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Dick, when you get a chance to watch that video, you'll realize that this professor is talking about one exact particular 90-degree plane for the impingement and reflections. That's where the cancellation takes place. And just like you said, change that and you lose the cancellation. So I just wanted to let you, the professor does mention that.
Yeah, to boil it down to a somewhat simple experiment, if I'm putting 1 watt into antenna A and 1 watt into antenna B, and I've carefully adjusted the frequencies, the phases, the cable lens, the positions, the aiming, and whatever. So I've got a point in space where the energy cancels. Yeah, I can make a cancellation in one point in space. But I'm really radiating 1 watt out of each antenna, a total of 2 watts. Continuously, 2 watts is going somewhere into space. Although I've done an interferometry cancellation at one particular point of observation, at a hell of a lot of other points, there ain't no cancellation. The energy that you're radiating is going somewhere. Energy cannot be destroyed. It can be converted to some other form. You can create a bunch of nulls in some places in space, but you must accept simultaneously you're going to get a bunch of peaks in some of the places in space. You can't null energy everywhere, if you know what I mean. I mean, there are lots of people who would like to believe that I'm going to make this very fancy machine. It's going to emit a complicated acoustic sound, and therefore all the other noises in the room, I'm going to cancel those noises. No way. Can't do that. Let me drop. By way of my noise-canceling earphones, at one particular point in space where my eardrum is located, yes, if it's got a good enough design, I can make a pretty good cancellation at that one particular point, but not everywhere. If you think you're going to cancel the noise in the room by some kind of fancy machinery, I want to sell you a bridge. I own a piece of it. I own a piece of the Empire State Building, so I want to sell you that too. You can't do that. So cancellations are very selective. As you move that handy-talky around the room and you think you see nulls, it's because the rubber duck on the handy-talky is a non-directional probe, and it's looking at the signal coming from the north, the south, the east, and the west, and putting them together, and in that one particular orientation of the rubber duck, in that one particular point in space, yes, you have found a null. When I move the probe along the slotted line, which is looking at a signal flowing from north to south and south to north on that line, because of that non-directional characteristic of that probe, I can find a null, and I can find a peak, and I can measure its standing wave ratio. Let me drop. But if I took the directional coupler probe out of a Bird wattmeter, and if I use it on the probe on my slotted line, even though I've got a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio on that slotted line, I slide that directional detector along my slotted line, there will be no peak, there will be no valley. I'll get a constant amount of forward power as I slide it. I reverse the slug and slide it, I'll get a constant amount of reverse power. There will be no visuar. So only when I'm using a non-directional detecting device, I can find what looks like nulls, but that peak and that valley on that slotted line doesn't exist. It's only your particular method of measurement with a non-directional probe that makes you think it exists. What Mother Nature does on all transmission lines, and this is a tough one for people to accept. Let me drop. The energy, the signal, whatever you want to call it, that flows from the shack toward the antenna. I'm going to call it the energy going up the cable. And if the antenna is less than perfect, the antenna reflects a certain amount of energy, and it starts flowing back down the cable. The cable itself keeps the energy flowing up and the energy flowing down thoroughly separate. It does not mix them together in any way. It keeps them separate. It doesn't know that there are two directions. Each one of those signals has a thoroughly independent pointing vector. It's got a certain E field, H field characteristic that gives it a direction of propagation, only one direction of propagation on that one-dimensional cable. The cable doesn't mix the signals. There's a hell of a lot of medium in the real world that do that. I drop a pebble into the north side of the pool, I will watch the waves travel to the south. I drop a pebble into the south side of the pool, I'll watch the waves travel to the north. I drop a pebble into the north and south side of the pool, and I'll watch those waves hit each other, fall through each other with no interaction. And you watch that and you'll say, wow, how does the water do that? As long as I keep the waves small enough so so that there's no white caps, there's no non-linearity of the waves. The waves will flow through each other. By the same token, I tap on the guy wire with my eye alongside of it, and I watch the pulse go up the cable. I watch it hit the tower, reverse in polarity, and come back down toward me. So I tap the guy wire once, I watch the pulse going up, it hits the tower, it's starting to come back down. I tap the guy wire a second time, I make a second pulse. So the second pulse is going up the guy wire, it encounters the first pulse coming back down, the two fold to each other with no interaction. A hell of a lot of transmitting media.
Repeater, time out.
A hell of a lot of transmitting media behave in that way. They're non-directional. Only when you put that very fancy, simple-looking thing called directional coupler that senses the power going in one direction and rejects it in the other direction by an internal interferometry-like technique, by the way, inside the directional coupler. Until I put that directional coupler in there, I'm not separating what goes up versus coming back down. So, free space propagation does all of this three-dimensionally to make nulls in space. They don't really exist. All of those radio waves from all of those broadcast stations are pouring through your house with no interaction with each other. The way you hold your particular radio and the way you tune it to particular frequencies and the way you set the polarization of the loop stick antenna, you will find nulls, you will find certain frequencies, you'll find positions in your house where it works better and not better, but that's not what the medium is really doing. All of those signals are really flowing nicely and smoothly through each other with no interaction. I know I've gotten off onto an entirely different subject here. It's time we go over to Paul. Hey, Paul, sorry I kept you waiting so long. WS2N, what's NASA doing this week? K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Paul.
WS2N. Very good, Zach. And I know John was asking about the proton detector. I thought he was talking about the APEX units that have been on every rover. You know, that's different. You know, that's where they have the, you know, in the detector they send out different waves, you know, beta waves or something, or alpha waves, I forget which. It's the rocks and whatever comes back, whatever protons come back, they detect that with a telescopic type of device. But he's talking about proton astronomy. To me, that's the, we'll cover that first. Well, you know, that would be cosmic rays, you know, coming from outer space. I mean, a lot of those things, cosmic rays are basically protons flying through space. You know, and of course, then you can have anti-protons, and that's where you're going to get into your telescope that's put on the space station, alpha spectrometer, alpha magnetic spectrometer. I think we'll cover that first. I got a couple of other topics back to you, Dick.
Just slowly coming back to me, Paul, the alpha magnetic spectrometer detects protons, antiprotons, electrons, anti-electrons, all of the above. By way of its extremely strong magnetic field, it can figure out what is the polarity of the object that just went through that detector, what is the velocity or kinetic energy of that particle. In other words, how heavy was it? How fast was it moving? Was it positively charged or negatively charged? Once you make, and the direction of travel, once you make all of those measurements, you rather easily select out whether or not that was a proton or antiproton. Was that an electron or an anti-electron? So the cosmic rays can consist of all of the above. There's nothing magic about a cosmic ray being all electron, all proton, all positron, all matter, all antimatter. Cosmic rays are all of the above, and that alpha magnetic spectrometer is really detecting all of the above, quantifying them, telling you what it was, where it came from, what direction it came from, and how potent it was. So, on top of that APEX experiment that's on the I seem to remember it's got a nuclear source on board that's emitting alpha, beta, gamma, whatever. It's emitting rays into the soil that you want to measure, and by the spectrum of what comes back, protons, electrons, or whatever, the spectrum of what comes back allows you to do a good job of recognizing what is that material. Was it sulfur? Is it a blank, blank type of rock, and so on? So they can do a kind of field analysis of what kind of material is under that apex detector when they aim it at the soil that they're going over. So without even digging into the soil, they can get a fair amount of information as to what kind of stuff they're driving over with that apex experiment, if I understand it correctly, Paul. WS2N, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Put on all the rovers. I mean, they started off with actually Sojourner, that little one, up in 96, that went up on Pathfinder, and that brought around, and that had one. And Opportunity and Spirit, they had the same thing, and same idea. They would put it up against the rock, and some kind of, I think it was cesium, I don't know, some radioactive type of device that was inside the detector would emit these alpha or beta waves, and it would hit the rock, and whatever came back, whatever protons came back, yeah, they could tell if it's sulfur or what they're looking at. And they've made big improvements since they've come up with that whole setup. I mean, they used to sit for 10 hours, you know, to sit there at nighttime while it wasn't really even driving around, and it would be sitting on a rock, and it would take all this time to figure out what it was made of. Curiosity, and they've improved on that, and you can do it in the daytime, nighttime, doesn't matter. And it figures it out pretty quick, I mean, very quick. Short period of time, and that saves a lot of time from dropping. That's getting away from it. I know what John was looking for. He's looking for the astronomy part. Yeah, that would be cosmic rays and the alpha magnetic spectrometer. The two of them, there was one before that they launched in space. This is actually the second one. The first one went up on a shuttle. It didn't attach to the space station. It actually went up to Mir, and it was inside the body of the shuttle. I think it was one of the final shuttle flights that went to Mir. And the technology was proven then. And this guy didn't have a cryogenically coils on it. He had real permanent magnets. I think they were probably neodymium magnets. It worked, you know, with that. I mean, you're not going to get the same effect, I guess, the intensity that you would get with super cool cryogenic system. Drop it. You don't really care, you know. They decided they were going to do that. They were going to put cryogenics on the space station, and it would have had like a 3-year life. But that's back when the space station was supposed to only last to 2015 or 2016 or something. Now they want to make it last to 20. I heard not too long ago, 2020. Now we're looking at 2028. And they're hoping for a 10 or even 18 year lifespan of this telescope attached to the space station. So they don't care. You know, if you have a machine that's going to be detecting stuff for 10 or 18 years compared to, 3 years, even so, the 3-year cryogenically cooled one would have been much more sensitive. You stretch that over time, and you're going to be way ahead with what they have now. And they don't need all this, you don't have to worry about the loss of the fuel, the cryogenics. They don't have to recharge it or anything. It's just permanent magnets. So I think that's pretty good. Back to you, Dick, and then we'll just do two launches that are coming up. Back to you, Dick. WS2N, space part of the TechNet.
alpha magnetic spectrometer, in the early proposal and construction, they thought they were going to go for cryogenic superconducting magnets, like you've got on the Large Hadron Collider, the LHC. And that gives you state-of-the-art magnetic field. That's the good news. The bad news, you've got to make a great big investment, and you've got to continuously supply the cryogenic, or it all goes down the tube. And so the cryogenic fuel would have definitely run out. They're way ahead of the game to use a little bit smaller magnet and magnetic field, but the best you can do with the neodymium. And now it's going to be up there for a good number of years, and it can detect some pretty exotic stuff. So in the next few years that it's up there, by definition, there's going to be a couple of significant supernovas and other kinds of celestial events. And that detector is sitting there ready to go, collecting those particles, recording it, and saying, this is what I saw. Now interpret it. What does it all mean? So, it's the most potent detector I know of that we've put into space so far. In other words, anything we've ever put into space so far, looking at cosmic rays, let me drop, some percentage of the time, your detector sees something so potent that it gets saturated. You peg the darn needle, if you know what I mean. Everything we put into space, just a matter of time before you peg it. I'm not saying that's destructive, but you don't make a real measurement. All you know is whatever you saw was big, and you don't know how big. Well, by way of this alpha magnetic spectrometer, which is the most potent magnet and one of the best detectors we've ever put up there, we meaning mankind, it's not just NASA, just not the United States. I think there's 16 nations or something like that and 100 universities involved in this particular project. And so it's a massive chunk of engineering. And I think it's detecting things 10 or 100 times stronger than we've ever been able to detect before. And once you're detecting things that strong, the next question is, was that antimatter? And a certain percent of the time, the answer is yes. Some of those really potent things are antimatter. And we've been somewhat blind to that in the past. So with the years of service it's going to give you, guarantee it's going to see some exotic things that's going to result in some very nice articles. And as I see it, astronomy, and this is a real astronomy experiment, can we drop? In my mind, astronomy is about the purest science there is. When you're involved in a science that tries to say, where did all this stuff come from? How did it get here? And are we alone in it? I mean, you ask really deep questions like that, you're into a very pure science. You can't make a whole lot of money on it. But there's still, if you've got any real curiosity as to the origin of the universe and mankind and all the other animals and plants and whatever, living and non-living things, if you've got any curiosity at all, you've got to be looking into astronomy as I see it. It's a very pure science. And in the process of pursuing that science, you come up with some very nice pieces of hardware that have applications in other places. Guarantee some of the hardware being designed for the exotic detectors for astronomy are going to result in medical detecting things. There's going to be some kind of an improvement of MRI and CAT scan and whatever. So you ain't heard the end of the story yet, as I see it. So what two launches are about to happen, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, I can't leave this way without asking one question. I know you've read a lot about that telescope attached to the space station. It's got all these magnets. I mean, I don't know, 10 or half a Tesla, whatever it is. Powerful magnets. What do you feel about this thing attached to the space station, being near all the sensitive other equipment on the space station? Or is this some kind of toroid type of thing where the magnetic field is contained there, guy? What do you know about that? I mean, how do they have the nerve to attach this thing to the space station without affecting anything?
I'm going to look into that further, Paul. I'm reasonably sure that the majority of that really potent magnetic field of some number of Tesla is contained That's a closed magnetic field within the detector. In other words, you only need a very strong magnetic field. I know it's not in units of volts per meter, but you know what I mean. The volts per meter maximum magnetic field only is required in the heart of the detector. And the particles that go through that section of the detector get deflected. And that deflection by Lenz's law tells you whether or not that was a positive or negatively charged particle. And how far it gets deflected tells you something about how much mass and how fast it was moving. And after it finally does smash into the detector and releases a certain amount of energy by a calorimetry-like experiment, you then know how many joules or kilojoules of energy it had before it hit your detector. So you only need a strong magnetic field in the heart of the detector. And so there's all kinds of ways of building a magnet so that to the outside world it's reasonably well sealed. If it had an extremely strong external magnetic field, I'm with you, it would be disturbing a hell of a lot of other stuff on the space station. Now, maybe you could put it into an inert place where its amount of the detriment is going to be small, but I'm reasonably sure that it was designed in such a way to have very little external field. Because if it had an extremely strong, if it had an extremely strong external field, I believe the space shuttle would be at risk to be carrying that thing. It would be disturbing a hell of a lot of sensitive stuff that's on the shuttle that allows you to do navigating and communicating and so on, orientation. So I'll bet you there's a bunch of pretty strict rules as to how much external magnetic field you're allowed to put on an object in that cargo hold. I'm going to do a little bit more looking into that one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, I know it's safe, though. You know, of course, the second one that they put into the back of the shuttle, the first one was a prototype, and then this thing was the real thing. So, very good. The two launches, well, you got one launch coming up this Wednesday out in California. It's a Pegasus launch. That's one where they put it on the body of a jet. They bring it up to 40,000 feet, and they drop it for 5 seconds, and then it launches. It's got a five-stage rocket, this Pegasus. So after it's dropped, it's going to go through all these different five stages, and it's going to put the IRIS spacecraft into orbit. And the company that launches this is the Orbital Sciences. They're the same group that launched the Antares rocket not too long ago as their first launch of that rocket from Wallops Island in Virginia. So it's a real, they've been around a long time doing this. Countless Pegasus launches and other launches. They have the Minotaur launches, rockets that have launched from Wallops Island, and a couple already from there, and even from Kodiak, Alaska. So it's a good company. They'll probably be competing against SpaceX. We drop it. And sure enough, they're putting this IRIS. It's the interface region image spectrograph. What it is, it's another one of these sun investigating telescopes. But it's supposed to be, I think I read, 10 or 15 times more powerful than what they put up there before. I haven't read too much about it, but I know it's supposed to be looking at the, very close in to the atmosphere of the sun. It's going to do some scientific studies. So they'll launch that this week on Wednesday. I think it's 10 or 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. And then there'll be the next big launch. You've got a Progress launch coming up. We've talked about many, many times. That's going up to the space station by the Russians to resupply the space station. This other one is, I'm waiting for a couple of months away. We'll talk about it more, but that's the Lottie mission. I think I talked about once or twice. atmosphere and dust environmental explorer. That's going to be launched from Wallops Island. You know, I always think of the interplanetary or lunar flights being launched from, you know, taking off from Florida. But this company, Orbital Science, again, same one that's doing the Pegasus, is going to be launching Nalati to the moon. And instead of launching out of Florida, a couple hundred miles away from here, maybe 500 miles down in Virginia on Wallops Island, they're going to put it on top of another five segmented rocket called the Minotaur. Minotaur 5. There's different sized Minotaur rockets that Orbital Science is using, and this will be their bigger one. But it's not as big as the Antares, the one that was just launched a month or two ago, as a test that will eventually be used to launch the Cygnus spacecraft, resupply spacecraft to the International Space Station. So here's a smaller rocket, Minotaur. Small, I mean, it's probably 100, a little over 100 feet tall, but it's relatively small, launching a spacecraft to the moon. Look how, you know, I mean, how far we've come. This thing is highly, you know, instrumented, all kinds of instruments on it. It probably weighs as much, I think it was 800 or 900 pounds, so it's probably like a, you know, putting a grand piano in orbit around the moon. It's not going to get there in 3 or 4 days like all the Surveyor missions or the Ranger missions or the Apollo missions that we had, you know, 3-4 days. This is going to take like 30 days, you know, or more. It's a slow, highly elliptical orbit, and eventually it gets an orbit around the moon, and then it'll do probably a half a year study of the moon. But here's this thing, like the size of a piano, being launched from Virginia, compared to like the Apollo days. So LEM, which landed on the moon, was in the 16 ton or 35,000 pound area. So you know, you're looking at something 1/30th of the weight of a LEM. Unmanned, doing all kinds of science, going to get probably quite a bit of science back. Probably, I don't know if it's going to be as much as a manned mission to the moon, but quite a bit. I mean, they want to study all its little atmospheric details. You don't think of the moon as having an atmosphere, but it does have, you know, a very rarefied particles in the atmosphere. And they want to check on that. They want to test it before... Well, we, you know, go up there and I'm not going to say pollute, but contaminate the near moon environment, you know, with all our stuff and rockets and, you know, all our maybe little colonies. Eventually, you're going to have people up there. I mean, the basic atmosphere, the pristine atmosphere, pretty much that's there now, is actually going to change over 10, 50, 100 years of man occupation of the lunar surface and the mining that's going to go on and all of this. So they want to get all the information now before we screw it all up. Back to you, Dick. That's pretty much it. But space nut, anybody wants to comment on or to me or questions, let me drop it. Drop it up on the... space portion of the TechNet. You could email me at spacenetreport@gmail.com. And by the way, it was good to see you and everybody else there down at Field Day, Dick. Seeing you down there again. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Way 1 VVH. Mr. VVH from Massachusetts, Northern Massachusetts. Looks like we're getting some good propagation up there tonight. Mr. VBH, listen, I can't remember your full call. Give us a few more words, KQRIW and the TechNet.
Hey, QSL.
No, just interrupting, right? A little bit of QSC though, it's up and down. Just want to let you know I'm listening here for the last hour or so while doing something else. Always enjoyable. So, you know, whenever I get the chance, I tune around here and just sort of lurk in the background. RAW, WI1.
WA1 VVH on the Massachusetts Northern Vermont border, as I remember, K2RIW. And here's a man with a significant Rhone 55 tower. You go to his particular QRZ.com listing, and you'll see a picture of him on his Rhone 55. Beautiful looking structure. Towers, there's real beauty in towers from my point of view. And thank you for checking in. Paul, I got to ask you, in the case of this Pegasus launch of the Aris, I think it is, five-stage rocket, run that by again. I've heard of three stages, and, you know, each stage gets smaller and smaller. The bottom great big stage is going to launch all the mass of all the other stages, but five stages, that sounds like a record to me. Run that by again, and how big is the final payload of the fifth stage? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I haven't seen an exploded view of the Pegasus. I should look that up, but I know it does have the five stages, similar to the Minotaur. The Minotaur rocket is another one of these five-stage things that's going to launch the Laddie to the moon. They call the Minotaur 5. If you look that up, I have looked at that, and it shows five separate rocket motors. I mean, it's one on top of the other. That's how they do it. And Pegasus has the same setup. So Pegasus is kind of like a smaller version of the Minotaur, except laying down, you know, on the side, and it's got wings to go through the atmosphere until it's out of the atmosphere. I don't know how long it takes before you don't need the wings. It gets to a certain point where you don't need them anymore once you get away from the atmosphere. But in the beginning, you definitely need them. So I'd have to look up the rocket thrust of all these different stages and all of that. Just, you're probably interested in that. Back to you there.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. I'm going to ask you a little bit more about the meeting we had last night. I first went to Motorola and talked to quite a few of the engineers that I know and looked at their field day operation. I then went to Lockfield, got in some very good conversations with them for a while. It took longer than I expected. It was fun, and they had some good food. Can't leave the good food. And then got a little bit lost on some of the parkways on the way over to Limark's field day setup. And a good crowd there. We had quite a meeting. I flashed some of my favorite tower pictures, and there's a report I was giving these guys about the award that was given to the technical med, and I was showing them what that award looks like. There's more to that story, but that's all I'm going to say for right now. But I think the meeting at the Limark field day site, I wanted to get there by, you know, 10 or so at night. I don't think I got there much before midnight. And when I left those guys, the sky wasn't really dark anymore. It was around nautical twilight, if you know what I mean. The sun was starting to rise. And so I wonder how long you had been there, Paul. And were you involved in the Limark operation? Or were you there as a visitor? So give me a few words on that one, Paul. And but you got into some good conversations, too. WS2N, K2RIW. Did you visit any other field day sites? You got it, Paul.
Usually we do. Usually we go to the Great South Bay, but this year we didn't do that. When I say we, I go over there with my son-in-law, who became a ham, KC2WMR. In fact, he usually drives. And we got there early and tried 6 meters. I was pretty much dead. Vista got through. I think that was a dupe. But then we left for a while. And then we came back. I guess that had to be around 10:30, 11. And then we stayed, that was probably around a quarter after 3, 3:30, I think, when I left. I know you were still there. Let me drop it. When we came back, Ken had gotten his radio back together. He was having problems with the... I'll have to find out what happened there. They haven't cured that, but he was having problems with 20 meters CW. Had this, like, raspy sound, and then, I mean, they fixed it. I mean, I don't know what they did. They didn't fix the radio, but they fixed the problem. They pushed over to, I think he said it was on the dipole, so when we came back, we were on 80 meters, and that worked out great, 80 meters CW. So, actually, we did that. My son-in-law was doing the computer, and I was copying the code. Of course, I love the code. That's pretty much it. Oh, we had to help with Barry. Barry was sitting there with the code, too, there every year. So for a while, we had three people doing two-in-one radio. Back to you, Dick, WS2R.
Did I hear you say that your son-in-law, Vincent, KC2WMR, was also doing some of the operating at Limark? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, he was doing the transmitting of the, you know, they have the, it's all programmed. And last year, I know they had, the last couple of years, they had a Kia there. Not really a Kia, a paddle, not electronic Kia, but a paddle set up. But, you know, if you wanted to use it, I didn't see that this year. So it was the only way to transmit on that particular one was they used a computer programmed in it. You know, you just push one button, and that'll send, W2BL, you know, you can call, and if you don't copy something, you hit another button, and it's got the question mark on it. Another button has the report, you're getting the section and all of that. So, he was getting good at that. I mean, he's to do the code, at that kind of speed, but he's getting the idea of when to push that button. you could start to, if the other guy, you could tell now if there's somebody talking to the other guy, and he's getting better at that. So, but that was a lot of fun. Back to you, Dick.
Because you were there earlier, Paul, you probably saw Andy, the A2CDL, who I know was planning to do a television, ham radio television fast scan demonstration. And not too far away is a good old Mike Cirillo, W2OTA, a television ham radio operator from way back. He's only been doing it for like 30 years, maybe more, maybe 40. So I wonder if you had a chance to see Andy's television demonstration, which I hope took place. I think I was beyond Andy's bedtime when I arrived, and therefore I didn't see Andy. So give me a couple of words on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, in fact, Mike was on. Of course, I was in the daytime. So, I had my camera. I took a picture of that. That was pretty cool. I've seen that before, but I wanted to see if it would come up my camera, and it did. I was able to have Mike's picture, the whole setup came out on the camera. I know Andy, he listens to the net, so he probably knows that. I already sent him a picture on it. He'll be able to use that. He'll like that. I sent him a copy. But yeah, that very nice setup. I like that ATV thing. But there's not many people on that, but I mean it's a perfect copy. It's really cool. Back to you, sir.
WJTV with a comment. Very fine, Joe. Get you in a second. I hope I said Mike Cirillo and not Joe Rispanti, another ATV enthusiast. W2OTA Mike, he used to have this, when I was active in television, was quite a few years ago. He had this great big screen that he would sit in front of a Hawaiian scene, and he would sit there with his Hawaiian shirt in front of his television camera, and he had split screen capability. I mean, he had an awful lot of broadcast standard capabilities in his setup. So the guys in ATV, boy, they can have a grand old time. The only disadvantage of ATV is the range is quite a bit shorter. When you're listening to a single sideband signal with a good set of earphones or a Morse code signal, the signal can be almost 50 or 60 decibels weaker than what is requirement to get a snow-free television picture. So even though you might be radiating a whole lot of power, except for some darn good, band openings, you tend not to get a whole lot of range out of television, so it tends to be a little bit more local. And one of the sad situations is that one of the very nice amateur television repeaters that existed in the New York area was on the World Trade Center, and so we lost it and one of its key operators during 9/11, who happened to be in the building because he's a broadcast engineer. Joe, I'm guessing you were at Limark Field A, and give us your impression of what it was like. I get a real kick out of those very fancy ladders with the wide nylon webbing into the earth screw anchors that support your towers. It's a very well-planned operation, I can tell. Nice, quiet power generators. It's quiet in operation. Looks like you guys have done a good job of refining it over the years. WJ2B, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Yeah, I missed seeing you there. I guess you got there a little later. I was there during the day when Andy was doing his ATV demonstration, and I got to have a nice little QSO with Mike at W2OTA. Saw his background, like you were talking about, with the tropical islands, and I actually brought my little ICOM R3 receiver. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's a little wideband receiver that has a 3-inch, maybe 2.5-inch color LCD screen on it. I bought one used a few months ago, and I was able to pick up Mike clear with just a 6-inch whip, you know, with a telescopic whip all the way down. And I think he was on 426 megahertz with AM, AM TV signal, and I was picking him up beautiful. The signal was the picture was actually clearer on my little R3 than it was on the Andy's big monitor. And we were chatting with him, and we had a really nice time. And they actually had a hex beam up there on one of the towers out on the side lot, and they had Jeff Ion's trailer tower that goes up about 40 feet. He has it welded and mounted to a boat trailer, and they tilt it upright, and then they have a crank that they can, I think it's a two-section tower, and that's a nice way to go. It's very very easy to set that up compared to having to put up tower sections or ladders or anything. So, we had a great time. I was there for about 6 hours, 7 hours yesterday. It was very, very nice, very enjoyable there. Back over to you, WJ2B.
That ION structure sounds like a fun thing. So your R3 got essentially a snow-free picture from Mike, W2OTA, on this handheld receiver of yours. And I guess in the old days, I'm trying to remember now, 439.25 was the official amateur TV wideband frequency, and now it's 426, and I can understand why, because if your carrier is on 439.25, and I can tell you where that crazy number came from, and the signal you're transmitting is 4 megacycles wide, you're obviously going to go quite a few megacycles above 440, which is really set aside for FM repeater operation on the 440 band. Let me drop. So I can see why they moved down to 426. 439.25 came about because some very naive person, way back in the dark ages of, I'm going to make a guess, 1970, said, hey, we've got this so-called 432 megacycle handband, which really extends from 420 to 430.